Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Chris Newell, and I'm one of the partners here at the Harbor Group of RBC Dominion Securities. And today I'm joined by our lead strategist, Robin Gullison. Robin today is going to go over his new report, which he just authored, entitled Central Banks Shifting Gears. And so without further ado, Robin, can you take us over the summary of your new report?
Yes, Chris, great, thank you. And thank you very much, everybody, for dialing in today. There's been a lot of things happening this year in markets. A lot of them have been driven by politics, and that's something as investors very difficult to forecast and what the impacts are going to be. But for the last month, the much bigger shift has come from the central banks. And it's been a big shift because central banks have spent the better part of the post-crisis era supporting markets with extraordinarily low interest rates, printing money to buy bonds to push long-term interest rates lower. And now some of those policies are starting to reverse. And it's actually happening in a bit of a coordinated fashion. As many of you probably know, the Bank of Canada raised interest rates today. The Federal Reserve in the U.S. raised interest rates last week. And we've gotten word in the past couple of weeks that places like the Bank of England and the European Central Bank are looking at removing the extraordinary stimulus on tap there as well. So that's been a pretty big shift in the interest rate outlook. We've seen interest rates of all stripes rise on the back of this news, which is good news for savers. And it has a lot of implications for markets as well, particularly in the currency market. So that's where we've seen a lot of volatility so far this year, not so much in the equity markets globally. Canadian equity markets definitely had some patches of volatility. But if you look at the U.S. market, it's been quite steady. Now we're starting to see volatility pick up in the currency and fixed income markets, and those have the potential to lead to volatility elsewhere.
Terrific. And Robin, you know, what is our view, if you can just please remind us, for equities for the balance of the year?
We still think equities are going to outperform fixed income, and that's, you know, equities are even more likely to outperform if we see interest rates continue to rise, because rising interest rates lead to falling bond prices all else equal, and we're in a situation with bond yields where yields are so low that it doesn't take much of a rise in interest rates and drop in price to wipe out a year's worth of yield. So we still think the equity market has some legs to it, particularly as the global economy is now growing on a coordinated basis, which we haven't seen for quite some time.
And you talk about rise in interest rates from the central bank. You know, today was the day that they released their decision. Can you tell us specifically what they said and what direction are they pointing towards?
Sure. So the Bank of Canada, as many of you probably recall, cut interest rates twice a couple of years ago on the back of the oil crisis. And this is a process, I think, of renormalizing rates and taking those rate cuts back. So they raised rates today, and they said they're going to be data dependent on further rate hikes. So they didn't pre-commit to raise rates again later this year, though RBC forecasts they'll raise rates again in October. But they said they're going to be data dependent. They're going to be watching the outlook for the economy and for inflation. So we still think they're likely to raise rates one more time because the Canadian economy has been doing fairly well. But I think they're also cognizant of some of the risks out there that we'll get to later in this talk.
Terrific. And central to your thesis on page number 3 of your report is that this is a slow growing but long lasting recovery. Can you give us a little insight into what you mean here?
Certainly. I think we've had this chart in a couple other presentations, and it's very simple but very effective, and it shows that simply the cycle in the US since 2009 at the bottom of the chart on page 3 is one of the lowest cumulative growing economies we've seen since the 1950s, but it's also one of the longest cycles. So that means that even though growth has been slow in the 2% range for all those years, because of that low growth, you haven't had inflation build up and you haven't had a lot of excesses build up. And those are typically the things that cause central banks to push rates high enough to push the economy into a recession. So for example, in the late 90s, you had the tech bubble. In the early 2000s, you had the housing bubble. Right now, there isn't really any obvious excess in the markets, and therefore central bankers aren't too concerned about pushing rates up to stop any excesses. I would say that the central bank's objective here is pushing rates higher, even though inflation is quite low. I think they want to give themselves some ammunition for when the next recession hits, so they're able to cut interest rates again, because I think extraordinary policies like quantitative easing may be politically even more difficult next time around than they were this time around.
Terrific. And the next thesis that you discuss is that we're seeing synchronized global growth, and by this I take it that you mean that that Europe and Japan are starting to perform a little better. Is that just their economies or their stock markets?
Well, it's been both. So for the longest time, the U.S. has been the main growth engine for the world, as growth in places like Europe and Japan have been quite soft. You know, Japan seems to have a technical recession, so two quarters of negative growth every few years. And Europe, of course, has been a perpetual laggard, especially with all of the political turmoil that's been taking place over the last few years. But we've really seen a bit of a new dawn in Europe this year. You know, we've seen a lot of the more traditional parties winning elections. The Euro breakup fears that were very prevalent in 2011 and 2012 have basically gone out the window. And at the same time, we've seen economic growth improve and the growth in those stock markets improve.
Fantastic. And, you know, oftentimes, discussion with clients, the idea of timing the markets comes up. And so you've said that you're quite positive on the markets and economic activity looks good and corporate profitability looks good. How important is valuation in the market to use as a timing tool when contemplating deploying funds into the markets?
That's a great question. And I think if you read the financial media, you'll see concerns over valuation for particularly the U.S. stock market on almost a daily basis. And, you know, it has some merit. Valuations are not what they were. You know, markets are closer to fully valued than they were 5 years ago. But in our experience, valuation is a poor timing tool. And you can see on the chart on page 6, and this is simply a chart of what the average change in the PE multiple for the S&P 500 is through each part of the economic cycle. And what it basically says is, in the early part of the cycle, the mid-cycle, and even the final year of the cycle, PE ratios tend to expand. And then the market takes that all back during a recession and bear market. So even though we haven't based expanding PEs as part of our main thesis, we're much more looking at earnings and dividend growth, something a lot more tangible that we think we can count on. The history has been that you tend to get rising PEs until you get a recession. And as far as the implications for the valuation of the market, what it means for returns, over the long term, there is an implication. Over the long term, your starting PE does affect historically what the 10-year return looks like. But over a one-year period, the starting PE has almost no correlation with the one-year return.
Interesting. And, you know, one of the strong drivers in return both in Canada than in the States has been technology. Are there any implications of this? Is this a bubble building in the technology market, or how should we be thinking about this, Robin?
Well, that's another statement that makes for really good newspaper reading. And you talk about another technology bubble, but really, if you look at the valuation of technology companies, they're by no means out of whack for the most part, with a few notable exceptions. And really, the technology outperforming, and the big thing the media has been focusing on is the contribution to the return of the S&P 500 from technology stocks. And you will see stories in the media saying, oh, if it wasn't for the FANG stocks, Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, and Google, the S&P 500 will only be up 2% instead of 7% or whatever it might be. I think it's actually closer to 9% year-to-date now. But really, that's pretty typical. And there's no need to go through the whole table on page 8, but basically what it says is that so far this year, the top five stocks have contributed 24% of the return, which is the exact same as the average since 1991. So because these large-cap stocks are such a big part of the index, it's natural that their movements are going to generate a lot of the return for the market. But if you look at the market itself and look at the average of all stocks, and the way we do that is looking at what's called the equally weighted S&P 500. So instead of weighting the stocks by their size, as the name suggests, each stock gets the same weight. Well, in the year ended June 30th, the equal weighted S&P 500 has almost the exact same return as the regular S&P 500. So that tells you that the average stock is participating here. It's just that these mega cap stocks are having an outsized effect on the index because they are very, very large stocks.
And, you know, on the next page, page number 9, you've got an interesting line chart on the S&P 500 as well as the TSX. And is this supposed to help us interpret why the Canadian market has been a disappointment this year and why Canadian equities have underperformed the U.S. market?
Yeah, so this shows simply the P.E. ratio of the S&P 500 over the last year and the P.E. ratio of the TSX over the last year. And you can see that basically since the election, when those P.E. ratios were equivalent, you've seen the S&P 500 P.E. ratio and therefore the S&P 500 market value go up quite substantially. Well, the TSX has gone the other way. And if you were to take these two lines and simply subtract them out, so take the S&P and subtract out the TSX, you'd get a differential of about 1.8. And if you were to graph that out over a long period of time, you'll see that the TSX is trading at the cheapest relative to the S&P 500 it has since 2008. And furthermore, typically when you get this kind of differential, this kind of premium for the S&P versus the TSX, it tends to be near an inflection point where the TSX starts to outperform. And of course, right now with oil being very volatile and the energy sector being massively out of favor, it's maybe hard to fathom a scenario where that happens. But I think if you were to get something like, even some sort of stability in the oil price around the $50 level, investor sentiment turning towards energy stocks, and interest rates starting to go higher, that would be a very positive combination for the TSX because you'd have the bank stocks and the insurance companies likely doing better. And, of course, the large weight in the energy stocks could do substantially better. They've been beat up pretty bad, so when they turn, it could be quite sharp and quite substantial. So this tells us that we think the TSX has a chance of outperforming in the second half of the year and taking back some of that underperformance it's had so far this year.
Well, that certainly would be refreshing. And you've got on the next page the valuation of Canadian banks versus a contingent of S&P 500 stocks. Can you shed some light on this page, please?
Sure. This is just a really simple look at what you pay to get a decent dividend yield in the U.S. versus Canada. So in Canada, we look at the banks as kind of a quintessential dividend growth stock. These stocks tend to have yields in the 4% range. They tend to grow their dividends in that mid-single-digit range with a fair degree of regularity, and they trade at a multiple of about 12 times earnings. If you were to look in the U.S. and look at all the stocks that yield between 3 and 5%, the average P.E. ratio is 26 times earnings. Now, I'm not suggesting the banks should or will trade at 26 times earnings. That would be really nice for our portfolios. But it tells you that the TSX bank stocks are among the cheapest, higher dividend yielding stocks in North America.
Thanks very much. And on page 12 of your report, you back on the Bank of Canada and the rate change that it made today. Could you talk about this a little bit?
Certainly. So page 12 shows the probability of a rate hike from the central bank in the next 6 months. And if the line is above one, that's telling you that the market is pricing in another rate hike by the end of this year. So we had one today. The market's pricing in another one by the end of this year. And if you were to go back a few months, the market would have been not even pricing in the rate hike we had today. So about a month ago, the Bank of Canada deputy governor kind of came out of nowhere at a university speech and said they were thinking about reducing monetary stimulus, which is central bank speak for we're going to raise interest rates. And this is only a few months after the central bank telling us repeatedly that they were considering cutting rates at their meeting. So this came as quite a shock to the market, and it had a massive impact on interest rates and specifically the currency. And this also coincided with a period where hedge funds and other leveraged investors had a record large short position in the Canadian dollar. So the record large amount of money in the futures market was betting against the Canadian dollar at the same time the central bank did a 180 on their monetary policy, and it led to an explosive gain for the Canadian dollar.
In the past, oil prices have been really highly correlated with crude oil prices.
No, the crude oil and Canadian dollar relationship has broken down, and it's really been all about interest rates. And over the long term, the relationship tends to be with interest rates, but if interest rates are stable between Canada and the U.S., so they're not changing all that much, you tend to see that correlation with oil pick up. Now, because Canadian interest rates have risen so much quicker than U.S. interest rates, particularly shorter-term ones, because the U.S. has already been on a well-established path to higher rates, that's been priced into their market, where our market has had a huge shift, you've seen the crude oil correlation with the Canadian dollar go down to almost nothing, while the correlation with interest rates and monetary policy has been very, very strong. I think that will fade as time goes on, and if oil continues to be volatile, and particularly trading lower, I think that's a risk to the Canadian dollar in the future.
And are we to take that this rising interest rate environment is confirmation of an improving economy and perhaps a better condition for equities in the Canadian market?
Well, to a degree, yes. You know, you've had a lot of commentary from the Bank of Canada and from Finance Minister Morneau that Canada is firing on all cylinders and we've had really good jobs numbers, really good economic growth numbers, and that's all true, but I think we also have to remember we are coming off of a big bust in the energy patch in the early part of 2016, so it's natural to see some sort of bounce back. So I think the Bank of Canada is trying to take away that emergency stimulus. They're probably a bit worried about the consumer debt levels in the country. In my opinion, they probably should have started this process a little bit earlier, but here we are today. And I think you know, there still are risks out there for the Canadian economy. There is the oil price is not really going in the right direction. There is a renegotiation of NAFTA, which has gotten a lot of attention lately. And, of course, there's the home market here in the GTA, and prices are now down about 16% over 2 months. Transactions are down even more. It remains to be seen if this is the start of something larger or just a bit of an anomaly after a huge spring market. But this is something we have to keep an eye on, and I think Canada is not necessarily out of the woods yet, and there are risks out there. But, yes, the near-term outlook has been much better than it was a year ago. There's no doubt about that.
Terrific. And in summary, do you want to touch on the main points that you've talked about today in your central bank shifting gears report?
Sure. I think the biggest change we've had in the last few months has definitely been the change in tone from the central banks. You know, the other factors at play that we look at, economic growth, earnings growth, those have been steady to better. So we've had, again, coordinated global growth for the first time in a while. Earnings growth has been particularly strong after not really going anywhere for a couple of years. And now we have the central banks finally realizing that we don't need emergency monetary policy anymore. And that's created some significant shifts, nowhere more so than in Canada, where we've had the Canadian dollar have a huge run. And I think a lot of people are going to look at the Canadian dollar and think about what it means there for their investments. Of course, it hurts foreign currency denominated investments, but we look at this as a bit of an opportunity. You know, the Canadian dollar did the same thing last year. It went from, call it round numbers, 70 cents to 80 cents, and didn't stay there that long, and it turned out to be an opportunity to buy U.S. dollars. The way we look at it, a lot of people have been waiting for a correction in U.S. and international stocks because they've had such a good year. Well, in Canadian dollar terms, you're now sitting on about a 5 to 6% correction from the highs in U.S. dollar and international stocks. So we think this is an opportunity start to put money to work in those sectors where people might have felt like they missed the boat just a couple of months ago.
And Robin, last question and a bit of an unscripted question here, but you know, what do you suggest for those individuals who have got a mortgage and have been playing the variable rate game over the whole life of their mortgage? Is now a time that they might want to call their banker and contemplate shifting from a variable rate mortgage to a fixed mortgage?
I think that makes sense, and it really depends on what kind of rate you can get, because I know some variable rate mortgages have very significant discounts from prime, and if that's the case, it may make sense to remain variable. But if the discount from prime is not that significant, or if you can switch into a fixed mortgage, still something in the mid-2s, to me that makes a lot of sense, you know, because prime is already up to 295, another rate hike takes that to 320, so even if you had a pretty big discount, you're approaching what you could probably get on a fixed rate mortgage today.
Terrific. Well, Robin, I really appreciate your taking the time today and appreciate everybody dialing in for today's call. And the report will be posted to our website. And, of course, any of us here at the Harbor Group would be just delighted to field your call and discuss it in more detail. And with that, we wish you a good day, and we will be back for the next regularly scheduled call in the month of August. Thank you, and bye.